Leaving the military doesn't mean leaving behind the weight of war. Maybe you're wrestling with how your service shaped you, or you're trying to make sense of the lessons that history keeps teaching us, but the leaders seem to ignore. What if you can see those patterns clearly, how past wars shaped our service, and how your service can shape what's next for you? Imagine feeling like you're not alone in that struggle, like your experience is part of a larger story that actually matters. Today, we're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Naughton, a soldier, historian, and author of Born from War, about the generational impact of military service, leadership lessons from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam, and what history tells us about the way we treat our veterans. His unique perspective, both as an infantryman and later as a medical officer, offer insight on leadership, transition, and the scars that service leaves behind. But before we dig into this episode, make sure you are subscribed to the email newsletter at driveonpodcast.com/subscribe. You'll get my 5 favorite episodes sent straight to your inbox. No fluff, just the best insights to help you drive on. I also want to take a moment to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians impacted by the global war on terrorism. This memorial serves as both a tribute to those who served and also a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you want to learn more about how you can support the mission, visit gwotmemorialfoundation.org. That's G-W-O-T. memorialfoundation.org. Now let's get into today's episode. Patrick, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here. Looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the invite. Definitely honored to be here, and I'm also looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into the military, kind of things that you did in the service, and kind of lead up, you know, what you're doing now.
Sure. Yeah, so it's been a long run. Joined in 2011, so I joined in 1996, joined in the delayed entry program. So, you know, my dad signed me off at 17, was 11 Bravo, went to the 101st for about 3 years, got out for a little bit, then I was in the National Guard, Guard, still is in 11 Bravo for more years. And then I went to, I moved to Las Vegas, went to ROTC, did about 3 years of that, got commissioned, came back in December 2004, and then came back in as a medical guy. So I was infantry when I was enlisted, switched over when I was a sergeant, so an NCO, and then became an officer as a medical guy. But since then, since I mentioned, you know, I've had a whole bunch of different assignments that are kind of very unique for the Army. You know, I've done the traditional, you know, units that everybody kind of goes through as a lieutenant, captain, and so on. And when I became a captain, I did some different things. So I was able to do the resident command and general staff college here at Fort Leavenworth, where I'm back again now. While there, I was able to do the Art of War Scholars Program. And from there, I did an interagency fellowship with the Army. So I was serving in D.C. in one of the federal 80s as a member of their staff. After that, I did 2 years in Congress as an Army liaison. I was on the Senate side, and then after that, became the G4 for the Surgeon General, and then now we're back in Fort Worth. I was an XO for a field hospital, then became the G4 for the Surgeon General, and now I'm back here at Fort Leavenworth teaching at the Command and General Staff College. It's been a very, very long, interesting career.
Well, it is interesting, and one of the things that, as an infantryman, you can relate to this, we have this... I don't know what it is about us, but we look at everyone else as less than you know, when we're infantry, right?
Right.
Except for Doc.
Right.
Doc,
yeah,
is the guy Doc who comes around and saves our ass when we do something stupid. So
yeah.
So you've got like the best of both worlds, it seems like.
Yeah, it's been interesting. And I will say, you know, if for anybody thinking about joining, you know, if you're with the infantry and you just do that for, you know, 3 years or whatever it is, that'll set you up for success for any job you want after. You'll always have that core soldier skills that you can fall back on that makes you really powerful if you want to switch over to officer or take on a different role, you know, after that.
Yeah, I found in my career some of the the officers who have, and this is not to knock any of the other officers that I had that didn't go this route, but the officers that went first and then became officers understood what the other guys were doing, the guys who are under them now, who were under their command, and it just seemed like there was a greater understanding. So I always like hearing those stories of the officer, you know, how
a shift went. And you know, it's I've seen it both. You know, I've seen you know, very successful officers make that switch, and then I've seen some who have never been able to kind of get out of that mindset. So they're like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, all my soldiers are going to love me. I'm going to be the best officer. They're filling sandbags, and I'm going to be filling sandbags. Right. And that's great, and that's noble. But if you're filling sandbags, then you're not leading your formation, and you're not in the meetings where you need to be in advocating for your soldiers and so on. So, yeah, you got to kind of find that balance, if you will. So I've seen that kind of be good and bad, turned out for some.
Yeah, so just a kind of interesting story. I was kind of thrown into sort of situation where I was a E5 sergeant and was deployed, and just over a matter of different circumstances, our platoon didn't have an officer. Like our PL was just not there, and our next higher ranking, I became the PL for a little while, and. I was so used to being there with the guys, like you said, like filling the sandbags, you know, working on the trucks and doing all the things that we needed to do to get ready for a mission. And things started getting a little out of hand and a little hectic and getting a little haywire. And one of the other sergeants in our platoon, he looked up, he goes, "Who the hell's in charge of this?"
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh shit, that was me."
That's me.
I guess I shouldn't be doing this stuff. You guys should be doing that. I should be getting, you know, prepared for this mission and, you know, letting people know what's actually going on and doing other know, leadership stuff that, I was just like thrown in the deep end. And but they do say like when you are in the military, to know your job, all the jobs, you know, but also several levels, you know, above yours as well. And it's for that reason, because you might just get thrown into a situation like that. And, luckily that only left a few days. And I was like, thank God this is over. Take it back. I don't want it.
Yeah. Right.
So, your book, Born from War, tell us about that book, kind of came from and you know, what it's all about.
Yeah. So my father, he was a Vietnam veteran, 2 years. He did 1 year in Vietnam and then 1 year at Fort Benning, an infantry officer, the 82nd Airborne for half of the war in Vietnam. And then his second half of his, he was an Arvin advisor to the South Vietnamese Army. So he kept all of his letters and his diary from his time in Vietnam. And so, you know, growing up, that was always kind of, he never really talked about Vietnam growing up, but that was kind of one of the things that influenced me to then join the Army, you know, that it was always in the background that my father was a combat veteran from Vietnam, and so it was always kind of there, you know. And then when you're a kid, you know, you always dig through your parents' stuff, and so I would find, you know, medals and those little green notebooks with the awards in them and so on, you're not really knowing what that stuff is. So that was really the heavy influence that caused me to join. But so, you know, I had really about 10 years ago, I started thinking about, man, I should do something with all of my dad's stuff. And that's really when I started getting into writing and writing articles and so on. And so I'd always wanted to write a book. So I thought, oh, man, it'd be a really cool idea to take my dad's year in Vietnam and then how, you know, write about how that influenced me to then join the Army and then my year in Iraq and kind of a back and forth of the similarities between the GWAT and then Vietnam. So that's basically what the book's about, and it talks about all that stuff. So it's really focused on that family part, but it all pulls back and talk about some of the strategic things that happened behind the scenes for both conflicts. And what I was really shocked when I did the research is how similar the same mistakes that we made in Vietnam were some of the same mistakes that we later made in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was really interesting to research and find that out.
Yeah, just looking at the parallels between Vietnam and Afghanistan specifically with the withdrawal and just it was almost like you could take some of the pictures from the wall and it was almost like you can put them side by side. And if you didn't know anything about either of those countries, I don't know that you would have been able to tell the difference between the two conflicts, because it just, I mean, it seemed like it was the same type of situation. And
absolutely,
you know, it kills me too, because it's like we did that already. And it wasn't, though, you know, some of the people who were in command, you know, positions, they were around for that type of thing. I mean, younger, obviously, but, they went to school. They learned about things. They took some history classes, I presume, at some point.
Yeah.
These same mistakes, right? But,
yeah,
but that's kind of what you're looking at, is looking at some of these generational impacts too, mm-hmm. right? And because not only was it from a higher up command level where mm-hmm. where there are people who knew what was going on in Vietnam, and then they're mm-hmm. they're in some sort of leadership position now, and but there's also things that the veterans who were on the ground fighting in Korea in World War II and all of mm-hmm. these other conflicts, but Vietnam specifically, mm-hmm. and they come home, they have some issues, they mm-hmm. they're dealing with them as best as they can. And, you know, we had our guys coming back from Afghanistan, Iraq, others, mm-hmm. you know, Africa and other places.
Yeah.
And they're coming, a lot of the similar issues. And mm-hmm. are we really dealing with them in the right way? Are we, right. have we learned those lessons? Or is it very similar to this withdrawal that we're talking about? Mm-hmm. You know, how did your father's experience in Vietnam influence your perspective on all of these things?
Yeah. You know, as I'm doing as I've done my research for the book and my other articles and so on, you know, I'm always struck about how similar all the experiences are for veterans, whether it was the American Civil War, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, all the way up to now. And so it's really striking. Like you said, you know, you could just remove the war, whatever clothing they were wearing, and it was almost kind of the same experience when they came back. And for Vietnam, obviously, you know, that's really an ugly stain on our national psyche of what happened to the veterans when they came back for. You know, I talk about that in the book. You know, I've interviewed a lot of people that my dad served with and talked about their experience of when they came back through California, and there are people at the gate and stuff spitting on them and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So that, you know, what happened to the Vietnam veterans is huge. It's a huge national stain. And I think we're finally coming to terms with that. And it's now honoring those Vietnam veterans. They start doing, you know, more parades for them, honor flights, things like that. So some of that, I think we've realized the mistake that the way that we treated those veterans when they came back. Yeah. And so I will say now with Iraq and Afghanistan, you don't see that. You know, you did not see that. You did not see the public turn against the actual soldiers who were being sent overseas to fight. And so I think that's one of the biggest, I guess, you know, positive lessons that came out of Vietnam, is that we learned, okay, you can disagree with the policy, you can disagree, and, you know, and you can vote. That's why we have voting, so you can, you know, make changes in that way if you want to, but, you know, you don't take it out on the soldiers who were sent over there to serve. So I think that's one of the biggest, you know, positive, I guess, good news stories you could say that came out of the war for veterans.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely been a shift in that mm-hmm. society's mindset of the war fighter and mm-hmm. the men and women who put on that uniform to mm-hmm. and do our country's work. And,
right.
I was at a event the other night, and it was an opening for a restaurant, the restaurant.
Yeah.
This isn't a promo for the restaurant or anything. It's just an attitude of the times that I experienced while I was there. It was just a whole room full of people, all their staff and everything were there, and just their appreciation for the military, mm-hmm. for first responders, for the men and women who put on a uniform of any sort. Mm-hmm. It could be police, firefighter, EMS. It could mm-hmm. be, military. It could be anyone. Their respect for those people was just extraordinary, and it was true respect. It wasn't this corporate, let's just hang a mm-hmm. banner and port our troops, and you know that, and then we mm-hmm. get the nice PR moment. It was a legitimate. You could tell these people actually cared, mm-hmm. and I was thinking about just God, what a great time to be a veteran is.
Yeah.
You know, in this time period where you don't have to worry about people mm-hmm. spitting on you, calling you names, and all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know that. I mean, just that right there, as you're saying, is such mm-hmm. a difference in mm-hmm. that time period where, you know, you come back from war, I would imagine, mm-hmm. maybe not being totally proud of some of the things that you had to do.
Right.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, some of that stuff, let's see the writing on the helmet from, I forget, mm-hmm. whatever it's from, War is Hell, and, it is. Mm-hmm. And you come back and people are... been thankful for it. It's like, well, what did I even do it for? So, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, seeing people like your father and other people coming back from these, mm-hmm. from combat over there is got to be, to see that, but great to see like the shift in society attitude towards that. Right. But, you know, I'm glad in that sense, at least history hasn't repeated itself.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely a good news story. You know, we were in D.C. stationed there, and I used to see the honor flights come in every time I was going TDY or whatever, all full of Vietnam veterans. You know, I write about the book, and, people in the airport would all stop and clap, you know, from their busy travels. Everybody would just stop and cheer them on as they were walking off the plane and so on. Definitely very refreshing to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, on the flip side of that, what were some of the lessons that you think from Vietnam that we were talking about, like, might have been overlooked in Iraq and Afghanistan, the global war on terror in general?
Yeah. You know, there's this book. It's called The War Managers. And it was a book written by a general officer who served in Vietnam. And he blind polled GO who served, you know, from all the branches who served in Vietnam. And they were all able to, you know, answer without retribution, without their names on it and so on. And the lessons that were in there, you know, I wish that that book had been handed to a person who was headed over to Iraq and Afghanistan instead of some of the other stuff that they made us read. Because there were so many lessons that could have been learned from that experience in Vietnam that we could have applied in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the two biggest ones, I think, are the, you know, commitment is number one. And so if we're going to go to war, if our political leaders decide that we're going to go pursue a conflict, you know, we cannot move past for whatever reason the political discussion, and we're going to move to conflict to further our aims, we have to be 100% in. We cannot do it with a volunteer force. You know, we need to fully mobilize. We need to apply all our resources against it. We have to stop this obsession with, you know, putting the least amount of resources towards it, trying to get the maximum amount of output. We have proven time and time again that does not work. So if we're going to commit, we've got to fully commit a force to it, and we've got to commit to it to the long haul. That's number one. And the second thing is, you know, the importance of our advisory role. So, you know, in all Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, we went, we assessed the local forces. We said, oh, they're not up to par yet to achieve our aims, so we need to insert American forces in order to buy time for us to train them, get them up to par to fight their own conflict. But as soon as you insert American forces on the ground, mission creep takes over, becomes the main effort, and it just takes on a life of its own, and then those local forces are pushed to the side. They're still being advised, but it's no longer that main effort, and we're not putting all our resources behind it. And then all of a sudden, we end up being there for 10 years. We start looking around and saying, what are we doing here? All right, we've got to turn it back over to the local forces, and by then it's too late. We've already neglected them for so long, and then we try to bring them up to speed very quickly, hand it over to them, and as we saw with the South Vietnamese, it did not go well, the Iraqi army. Some success stories, you know, it's not as bad now, but we're still supporting them, you know, over the horizon type stuff, and then obviously Afghanistan. So I think that's the two biggest lessons, is that full commitment, number one, and number two is really assess and put our effort behind those local forces if that's who we're going to try to prop up to take over the conflict.
Yeah, those local forces, we had some interaction with the Afghan army, the Afghan border police, and we had a bunch of different interactions with the locals, and when they not up to par, I think they were playing a different game, never mind not being up to par.
right.
We would get them for training, and I mean, if they lasted an hour training with us, that would be a miracle.
Yeah.
What do you do with that? You know,
right.
At some point, this is my opinion anyways. You may or may not agree with this opinion, and that's totally fine. But my opinion is that at some point you have to kind of realize that maybe their want for this is not as great as ours. They just maybe want to go and just continue living their lives as is. And if the Taliban's in charge, then the Taliban's in charge. Somebody else is in charge, and somebody else is in charge, but just leave me alone.
Yeah.
Is maybe the attitude that they have. And so we wanted to go and go kick some ass because we just had, you know, a bunch of our fellow countrymen and women killed. You know, and we wanted to go get some revenge. And we had that, that burning desire inside of us, but they didn't really care. Didn't seem that way anyways.
And if that's the assessment, again, you shift back to that first point, is that, okay, if they're not going to achieve the goals that we want, then we've got to fully apply our commitment to it and not do it half-heartedly. We've got to fully apply, you know, more than one or two divisions and get after what we're trying to get after. But again, it goes back to, you know, the obsession that we have going back to really to the end of World War II, is trying to do this limited amount of commitment and trying to achieve this maximum outcome through just air. You know, you see that in the Balkans. Oh, we're just going to do things from the air, just do tomahawk diplomacy. And it just doesn't work. You know, time and again, And, you know, you look at, so my dad, you know, he advised the South Vietnamese, the common soldier, the South Vietnamese soldier, was a tiger on the battlefield. But once to that operational level, you got to those brigade and division command, that's where it really all fell apart. And so, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, that advisory piece, you know, how do you assess it? You know, how do you find ways to make them gain the same, you know, gain this or want the same objectives that you do? Yeah, it's very, very complicated.
Well, and as you're talking, it gets me thinking about like a company, and I'm not talking military company. Mm-hmm. It could be that, but in a business, somebody who's really great at making whatever widget you're making, right, in a company, and they're the best widget maker that the world has ever seen, and the company's like, well, we need to promote this guy, and we mm-hmm. need to get this guy to, you know, higher up, and then he becomes management level, and he's, you know, moving up in the company, and he starts falling apart. And right. he's not able to perform. He's not able to do this because what he was good at was making those widgets.
Right.
He wasn't good at leading people. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, you were talking about the South Vietnamese and the, they were tiger on the battle. They were, mm-hmm. they were absolutely incredible on the battlefield. But when you took them out of that situation to a leadership role, then that's where things kind of started falling apart. And so, mm-hmm. Sometimes I think we have to look at people for their leadership ability and not their ability to do whatever that job was that they were tasked for,
right.
If that makes sense, right?
Yeah, no, you got to do that analysis and, you know, that old the bus analogy, you know, you've got to get the right people in the right seats and sometimes you get that wrong.
Yeah, that's right. And it's unfortunate because, you know, you want to be able to promote those people and mm-hmm. get them higher pay and higher and all those types of things, but at the end of the day, if that's what they're really doing,
excuse me,
and if that's what they're really, that's what they are, that's where they want to be, then that's where we should, I think, where we should probably keep them. And
yeah, because some people are, you know, they're not good operational and strategic leaders, and that's perfectly fine, right? You find that the talent where they fit well in. And then you just keep them in those roles, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's, I don't think that that's a bad thing, right? But
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, not at all.
So we're learning lessons, right? We're starting mm-hmm. to see some parallels between, you know, Vietnam, between mm-hmm. Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean the global war on terror in general.
Right, yeah.
You know, 'cause I know there's other theaters.
Other theaters, yeah.
You know, But between the global war on terrorism, mm-hmm. between Vietnam, between, you know, all these different conflicts, we're seeing these parallels that are, mm-hmm. are being drawn there. So you're training future military leaders, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about leadership and you know, at whatever that mm-hmm. that role was, but are they cut out there? Mm-hmm. You know, what leadership qualities do you look for in that type of person that you're trying to advance? You're like, mm-hmm. yeah, you could be great at making that widget, but then you're moving mm-hmm. up into a leadership role. How do we know that we have the right person for that leadership role?
Yeah, I mean, you know, observation of how you know, but kind of the way, you know, good way to assess it is, you know, going back to the comments earlier about the infantry. So when you're raised in the infantry, you know, you have a certain mindset. If you're not infantry, you're not anything. You know, you're looking at badges and tabs and so on. And if you don't have a Ranger tab or you don't have a CIB or whatever it is, then, you know, you're not value added to the nation, or you can't speak up at this meeting that we're in. You know, that type of thing. So when you're looking at somebody trying to make a shift from that direct, you know, tactical level leadership, you're looking at people who can look past that. You know, people who can lead with empathy, people who can understand, you know, looking past stereotypes, looking past badges and tabs, and try to, you know, use that leadership that they have, extend that influence, and try to get the best out of that person. Because everybody has something valuable to add, and it's up to you as the leader to try to find what that is. Exactly what you're talking about, you know, putting the buses, or the people in the right, you got to find out what their skills, knowledge, you know, knowledge, skills, attributes are as that leader. Discover that from everybody, and then put them in the right roles and so on. So that's really what you want once you start getting to that operational level of leadership, is being able to look past, you know, all that stuff that stuff that doesn't really mean anything, and really be able to assess people all the way down to their core, and then being able to find the best value, get the best value out of them, and put them in the right places and so on.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, putting them in the right places too. Mm-hmm. It, you know, not trying to fit a square peg through a round hole. And if, if that person's not cut out for, you know, a certain position, then okay, not a big deal. Yeah. You're not cut out for it. And that's, it is what it is. And, and we'll get the right person in that, that role. And, as a group, we all get better when we have the right people in the right role, because otherwise you end up having somebody who they don't very effectively, then there's that, that issue like I was dealing with that I was talking about earlier, when someone was like, well, who the hell's in charge? And it's like, oh,
right. Man. Yeah.
You know, it's like you end up with situations like that. And I, like, I wasn't the right person for that. I mean, I may have been with the right training and whatever, but I was just kind of thrown into it. So no, I was not the right person at that point. And I was super relieved when I was no longer in that position. But
and then, you know, and also at that level, you know, you talk about finding, you know, the right talent and molding people and so on. Yeah. But you know, sometimes that individual is just not cut out for the military or the organization that you're in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as that leader, you have to also be able to, sometimes the best thing for that person and for the organization is to separate that person from the organization.
Right.
So you've got to be able to do that as well as a leader, and not try to be everybody's best friend. You know, you're the leader. So at the same time, someone who just, you know, you give them chances, if they absolutely are just not cut out for whatever reason, then, you know, you've got to separate them from the organization.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're right. There's sometimes that nurturing that person and helping them grow and whatever could help get them into, you know, could mold them into the right type of person. But sometimes you can, I think we've all probably had some people in our military careers where, you know what, I don't know how that, what was that recruiter thinking?
Yeah. You
know? But the recruiter was thinking about
numbers,
their numbers, and making sure that they met their quota for whatever time period. That's their, I guess, their obsession. Is with that. But you know, you're talking about quotas and numbers and metrics and things like that. You do talk about those metrics in your book. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as Vietnam, global war on terrorism. How can we look at that and look at? It's always good to have.
Yeah.
You want to know, you know, certain data points, but it's more than just that, right? It's more than just data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, you know, and so, you know, being a GWAT veteran, you know, we've obviously, all of us have been exposed to that obsession with that green metric, right? And so we fought the wars by PowerPoint and Excel spreadsheets, trying to chase after these numbers that get us to whatever bubble chart that's green. And so, like you said, you know, and all this obsession starts with Vietnam, you know, with the body count is kind of the biggest one that everybody remembers, but there was a whole host of other metrics that they were measuring. And like our conflicts, it took over and it became the driving force for the war. And that's how you were measuring success. That really started with Vietnam and never ended, you know, still kind of going on today, but kind of to a lesser extent, thankfully. But yeah, you know, so conflict, messy, right? It's super messy. Anything with human beings is messy. You know, conflict probably being the tip of the spear of that messiness. So trying to, you know, measure that in some type of scientific way, it has value. Like you said, you know, there's some value to it, but it should not be the thing that takes over and becomes the forefront and becomes the driving force for everything that we're doing. So, yeah, okay, we've got a green metric, but what's actually behind that? Like, let's talk about what's behind that. That made that green metric. How did we get there? What human things did we do? How did we influence whatever to get to that metric versus this? All right, it's green. Why is it 72 and it should be, you know, 82? Let's get four numbers on there, you know? And then so that also has really harmed the profession, the military as a profession as well, because now you're putting pressure on people to fudge numbers. And everybody in the military has seen that happen. And once that fudging starts happening, it really starts eroding away at that our profession. So I think there's value added, but there's definitely a danger to it. We shouldn't become obsessed with it. You know, it's a tool, but it's not the end all be all to any time we go into conflict. That becomes our way to measure success, if you will.
Yeah, and it really makes those data points irrelevant if we're going to start just fudging numbers and just putting whatever just to get a green and pass whatever that metric is. That metric is useless.
And then once we get green, we're like, next.
Yeah.
And and there's still stuff in there, that metric, that we need to focus on. But because we got it to green, we're good. Let's get to the next one and get that next red or amber to green.
Right, exactly. And so one of the things that I look at when I'm looking at numbers like that is mm-hmm. what happens after it gets to green. You know, yeah. do you get, if it's some performance metric or whatever, and you see a chart of all the data points that are leading up to that green, and it gets, yeah. it's, you know, it's a rocky road, it's going up, and, you know, eventually mm-hmm. you get that green. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Now the focus of whoever was in charge of that green metric, whatever mm-hmm. that was, their focus is now on something else.
Something else, so
now you look at that green metric and it's starting to slip back down.
Yeah, and exactly, it's, yeah.
And so the problem, whatever the problem was that they were trying to solve to get mm-hmm. to that green metric, never really got solved. It got fixed yeah. temporarily. You know, yep. it's like putting duct tape over a hole yeah. on a boat or something. And, and you're, as soon as that duct tape starts to lose its stickiness, you're going to get yeah. that water back in the boat. And, yeah. And so, yeah, temporarily you solved the problem, but you didn't, or temporarily you fixed the problem, but you didn't actually mm-hmm. solve the problem. And so, mm-hmm. you know, when you're looking at those metrics, I think the more important thing to your point is what's going on behind that number and mm-hmm. what's going on to make sure that that number either stays level at right. where it's at or continues to climb if that's the direction yeah. that you want it to go, or decrease depending on what it is.
Yeah.
If it's a good or a bad metric depending on right. whatever, you know. You want to see, like, how do we sustain that, whatever mm-hmm. that is, right? And that's a challenge when you're just focused on that one pinpoint in time mm-hmm. and said, yep, okay, at the end of this quarter we had 50% fewer, you know, injuries or whatever mm-hmm. the metric is. Okay, now let's go focus on some other metric, and now injuries start creeping back up.
Yep, yep.
Because you're not paying attention to the safety and things like
yeah.
that. It's
riding that metric wave, right?
Right.
And so I'm hoping that, you know, the AI, you know, we're really kind of leaning into AI. So I'm hoping that it doesn't go the way that metric's driving force for everything that we're doing.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that AI will be able to look across all those metrics, right, and be able to get after exactly what you're just saying and hopefully find trends and find the discovery behind them. You know, that would kind of be the goal of AI, I would hope, that we're yeah. able to do with it.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, because mm-hmm. I've found that AI is able to take a large data set
yeah.
and kind of just sift through all of the data in,
right.
and make sense of it in a way that you and I could do. You know, yeah. we're intelligent people. We can do it. It might take me a week or two to sift, right. read through all of it and start, you know, compiling charts and mm-hmm. making the graphs and stuff like that, where you feed it to AI and, you know, let it do its thing. And yeah. sometimes within, you know, a minute or so, you have all of that same yeah. digitized and everything like that. And so that, in my mind, is the ideal situation, because then you can mm-hmm. now start digging into those numbers instead of just mm-hmm. playing around with those numbers and trying to.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, hopefully right. AI will take that more holistic approach. You know, one of the interesting metrics in Vietnam, you know, I wrote about in the book as well, is that, so they were tracking how many weapons they were capturing on the battlefield from the enemy. And so this was a number, right? I captured 10 AK-47s today, and I captured 15 AK-47s today, the next day. And then, you know, they traced that over time, and the number was just going up hugely, you know, over the years. And so the way they assess that is that, oh, the NVA and the Viet Cong, we are hammering them so hard that they don't even have time to recover their weapons off their dead soldiers and so on. And what it turned out being is that they were being so well supplied from China that they lost an AK-47 or an older machine gun or whatever. They didn't care. They just left it there because they had 10 more back, you know, hidden somewhere. So,
sure.
you know, maybe AI could have taken that more holistic approach and look at, you know, Chinese arms sales and all those things that maybe we would not have even have assessed at our level and right. been able to get that broader picture. You know, I don't know. Hopefully that's what we can do with it.
Well, and, you know, there's another interesting thing that I think it came out of World War II. I forget exactly which war it came out of, but they were looking at the planes that were coming, and they were looking at where the bullet holes were hitting
underneath
the plane, right? And they were looking at those, and they're like, okay, well, we need to, the first thought was we need to strengthen the armor where these bullet mm-hmm. holes are hitting. And then someone was like, well, no, in the armor where the bullet holes aren't, because the planes that aren't making it back are the ones that are getting the bullet holes in those places.
Yeah,
so we need
to
strengthen it in the opposite locations. It was a little counterintuitive, but it was just that like the light bulb went off in that one guy's head, and it made him say, well, no, those are the planes that made it back. The planes are obviously capable of flying with bullet holes in these locations. So let's not worry about those locations right now. Let's worry about those other locations, you know, the fuel tank or whatever, you know? And so, you know, it's that, we can get into statistics and these kind of things. Right. But, you know, and we can, I probably nerd out about that kind of stuff quite a bit, but when you lose that human touch, then you're just looking at numbers, and you might as well just be a computer that's looking at, right? If you hit the computer and just say whatever it tells me, yes or no, or, you know, good or bad, or whatever it is, you know, green or red, or, you know, some other metric, then you're missing of that. So yeah, fine. Use the computer, use the AI tools, use the that are out there, but use them in a way that enables you to make faster decisions based on that data, but still incorporate some of that human.
Humanity, absolutely. You know, that's kind of the danger of it. You know, if you put somebody like me and try to teach, you know, train me to read and assess something that comes out of AI, probably not going to be successful. So, you know, we see this younger generation coming up. They're going to be growing up with AI. Yeah. So when they come into the Army, you know, it's going to be very comfortable for them. They're going to know, you know, how to assess that data and so on and put that human touch onto it. At least I hope. But you know, it's a very good point.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm looking at like my kids. They're not yet of military age, but, you know, the things that they are doing with computers. And I think to myself at their age and the things I was doing with computers, it's like, night and day. You might as well. Yeah. I might as well have been a caveman at that point. You know, with the things that I was doing, and they're doing all sorts of crazy things, and it's it's great. But I see that the people in this generation, they lose some of the skills that maybe we were growing up. I'm sure your teachers, your math teachers in school were telling you that you're not going to have a calculator to carry around with you in your pocket all the time. And it turns out that was wrong.
Yeah, but that's wrong. It's not true at all.
But you know, like we had to learn how to do mental math. And kids nowadays, like, why? Like, everybody has a calculator. Why would I need to?
No, you know, as a historian, you know, younger kids now, they can't even read cursive. So they can't even read, you know, letters from the Civil War or whatever. Interesting.
That is interesting. That's one thing that we make sure that we taught our kids is how to write cursive, so that they don't lose it.
Right.
You're right. Like a lot of their peers don't know how to write
teach
cursive
it anymore.
And it's a dying art form. And you know, it's, I mean, that's the way the whole world communicated.
Yeah.
You know, in written language, anyways. For the longest time.
And so, long time.
looking back at even like old historical documents, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, those are all in cursive.
Cursive, yeah.
Good luck.
yeah, it's true.
So your book also touches on some of the, just kind of shifting gears a little bit here, touches on some of the struggles of reintegration. I'm sure you experienced some of that with your father, you know, probably maybe even yourself a little bit as well. But, what advice do you have for veterans who may be disconnected from civilian life?
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's kind of one of the things I always try to tell people who are transitioning and so on is, you know, everybody always tells you that, hey, a lot of your skills are not transferable, you know, from the military to the civilian world. So, you know, if you were an infantry officer or an armor officer or whatever, you know, there's not really a lot of jobs, you know, driving tanks and things like that. So, like, so they always tell you that, you know, you have to change the way that you act, and you have to change the way that you know, present yourself in some ways and some of those skills, and understand that those are not desirable skills for the civilian market and so on. So I would say, yeah, that's a valid point, but I would focus on the skills that are transferable. Mm-hmm. And they're really just basic skills that many in society do not have, in the civilian society do not have. And they're just like simple little things like proper grooming, right? Showing up to a job interview with your haircut, you know, shaving. I mean, that's things that are driven to you that, you know, a lot of people in society don't even think about that. And they show up with dirty shirts and things like that. Being time, standing up when your boss comes and talks to you when you're sitting at your desk, Just little things like that, you know, being respectful towards people, looking people in the eye, shaking their hand, you know, all those little things that you learn in the military, which you don't realize are really strengths for you. A lot of society does not have and does not really practice anymore. So I always say, yes, understand that there's some things that are non-transferable, but you also have a host of like basic skills that are, that you think are not highly valuable, but they are. And so focus on those as you're doing that reintegration, because that's going to take you a very long way. And then the second thing is, you know, that disconnection that you might feel. I always, you know, try to find something that you can pour some of your passion into. You know, most of us who join the military, passionate people, even though we try to hide it and say that we're tough and so on. But we join it because we want to be part of something bigger. You know, we find, you know, wearing that flag on our shoulder and being defending the Constitution and all those types of things, we find that honorable, and we find that that's a passion in us. So you've got to find something that you can now pour that passion into. So for me, it's writing. But for others, it might be simple things like, I don't know, cooking, working on engines. I mean, whatever, you know, a podcast for you. Something like you can pour your passion into, that'll help you, in my opinion, you know, make that reintegration and find the substitute for that passion that you miss in the military.
Yeah, and I like how you used examples of things that are not necessarily your job.
Right.
You can have a job doing whatever, but you can still have that other passion, passion project, a hobby, a thing like that that's on the side. That's a thing that you come home to at night, and you get to look forward to that thing that you get to do. You know, maybe it's working on an engine or making a nice meal for your family, or you know, working in your garden, or
absolutely,
whatever that can be. You know, there's so many different things out there that people could be passionate. But I found that not having something that you have, like, what do you have to look forward to?
Yeah.
Like, if you hate that job and you're like, oh man. Yeah, you know, obviously, if you hate your job, like that's not an ideal situation. That's maybe an extreme example. But if you're you know, just lukewarm about the job and it's, you know, the thing that's paying the bills, well, think about it. Like, it's the thing that enables you to be able to do those things that you do enjoy, and you know, look at it that way, and be able to. Going back to some of the first points that you were making, showing up on time. Having a good haircut and you know, looking presentable and just all that stuff is gonna set you ahead of probably
big time
80-90% of the population, and then that extra 10-20% is going to be your work ethic, you know, the abilities that you bring to the table, let's face it, everybody who has ever served in the military, I don't care for, you know, 2 or 3 years or up to 20 plus years, we've all learned how to do something. We all are trainable. And even if you were an infantryman and sure, there's not a whole lot of jobs that you're going to be applying infantry skills and tactics to in the civilian world. You might be a mercenary or something, and you know, maybe you can find a job like that, but you know, let's just face it, most people are not going to find those types of jobs. But if you can do those that you were bringing up and all those things, and hey, you had to learn how to be an infantryman. You didn't go into the army, the Marines or whatever, being an infantryman with those skills. You had to learn. And so you can learn how to do another job too.
And with that learning, you know, you've got to be able to check your ego a little bit, because, you know, if you're coming out, again, perfect example, infantrymen got trained by a bunch of, you know, hardcore drill sergeants, just spent time in the 82nd of planes, and now I'm transitioning to whatever, and I've got maybe a 24, 25 year old training me to do this job.
Yeah.
You know, in the back of your mind, oh, wait a minute, I've done all these cool things. Like, why am I listening to you? You know, you've got to be able to kind of check your ego a little bit. I'd be like, all right, this person is 24, 25, but they obviously know this skill because they are training me in this for this position. So I've got to really, you know, pick their brain and really actually learn what my new job is going to be. I think definitely like all those things that you just talked about. But at the same time, you know, we've also got to be able to kind of check ourselves when we make that transition. And when we're dealing with people who have know nothing about the military and have no experience with it, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a great point. Mm-hmm. It's got to be hard for some people who are coming out. Maybe they're, you know, 30, 35 years old, whatever.
Right.
And yeah. they're being trained by a 25-year-old guy. And like, really? I got to listen to you? Like,
you
might still live at home with your
parents. Right. Yeah.
Right? It's like why am I listening to you? But they're the ones who have been doing it for the last few years, and you haven't. And so, yeah, you got stuff to learn. And be humble. And, you know, I got into the military. I was a little bit older than most people are when they get in. And, you know, I was like somewhere around there. Not too incredibly older, but I was same age as some of my drill instructors and the drill sergeants. And, you know, when I was going through, it's like, you know, we're almost peers, like we're high school together, you know?
Right.
And, but I didn't change the fact that they were still screaming down screaming, you know, telling me to do push-ups and do all these things. And if I had a chip on my shoulder, you know how many more push-ups I would have had to do?
Yeah, so, right, exactly.
I'm checking that ego real quick.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
You know, think of that 25-year-old kid who's training you as your drill sergeant or drill instructor or whatever. And, you know, you start getting a chip on your shoulder, go smoke yourself. And
exactly. Yeah. That's the way to
get
do it.
Get it out of the way.
That's a good point. That's funny.
but yeah, I mean, it's just mindset, right? You got to have the right mindset going into these things. You know, I know we have a lot of issues with mental health, going into, you know, people coming out of the military. We had it in Vietnam. We just didn't talk about it in prior conflict. We're talking about it now a little bit more. And, you know, we are seeing the suicide rates that are going up, you know, amongst post 9/11 veterans, but even Vietnam era. I was actually surprised, a few years ago, I was looking at some numbers and, a good chunk of 22 a day number was coming from people who were in their 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And that's not our generation. That's the older, you know, Vietnam era generation. And, that was kind of surprising to me. I was expecting it all to be like post 9/11, veterans.
Right.
And,
yeah.
But not to say that post 9/11 veterans aren't having that problem too. So, you know, we got to those people to seek help and,
absolutely.
You know, whether it's Vietnam era, whether post 9/11 or any of those eras, you know, if you're struggling, go get some help, talk to somebody. And there's people.
No, absolutely.
There, right?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, doing the research for the book and so on, you know, it kind of made me realize, and this is probably true for a lot of GWAT veterans, is that, you know, I know more people who committed suicide than I do who died in combat in GWAT. You know, so, and I think it's probably the truth for most of us.
Right.
And so, you know, Vietnam, you know, when I asked my dad's generation about it, kind of like you just alluded to, they were like, oh, that was not our problem. That's your generation's problem. But it's not true. I mean, it's been every conflict's problems had that exact same thing. Like you said, they just didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the beauty of today is that there's so many different avenues and mediums that are talking about it. For example, your podcasts, there's the, you know, mainstream media, there's all types of, you know, VS veteran service organizations that are trying to offer help and things like that. So I think it's great that it's really being brought into the open, which I think is a very positive thing for our generation. And so, you know, I applaud you for what you're doing with this podcast and, you know, really bringing that and making it not uncomfortable to talk about anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, I try to, I guess you could say lead by example, because I'll come out on this show and I'll talk about my struggles, the things that I've done and to get help and go get mental health, you know, support and utilize those resources. And sometimes for those people who are out there struggling and suffering alone and they're like, it's, you know, I'll be fine. You know, I'm tough and I can deal with it and all that. Sometimes all they need to do is just hear that, hey, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to go talk about it and get the help that you need. And that's what I try to do. It's like, I'm not perfect. Mm-hmm. Like I'm sitting here, I'm hosting this podcast and I'm trying to share resources and stories from other people, but I'm not perfect either. And I need help. I still go to therapy and it's good. You know, I look at myself as a continuous work in progress and I'll get there eventually, but today's not that day. And so I still got work to do and I'm going to keep doing the work until I don't need to do it anymore. And you know, if you're out there and you're struggling, you're suffering and you're just kicking the can down, doing anything to better yourself or or mm-hmm. change whatever situation that you find yourself in. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, man, look in the mirror. That's kind of your problem.
Yeah.
Like you gotta figure it out and do something to make that change.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to that passion piece, which we talked about earlier,
yeah.
that passion, you know, something else is going to, whether it's alcohol, drugs, depression, mm-hmm. something is going to take that space over. So it's really important to find that passion. And, you know, and I'll say for kind of a plug for senior leadership, you know, both in the military and for in the civilian world, you know, a lot of senior leaders now will, you know, they kind of poo-poo social media,
yeah.
not understanding that the younger generation, that's where they are now living out their lives for good, bad, or, you know, or whatever. But so if you're not in that space, you're missing out a whole lot as a leader. So, I can't tell you how many suicides I've prevented because I was friends on social media with one of my subordinates, and I saw something that they put in there that really set off some alarm bells, and we were able to intervene and get them help when they needed it. So I would say not to be, you know, for a senior leader, older person, I would say don't be afraid of social media. Embrace it, you know, use it for what it is, and that way you can kind of monitor your subordinates and really be able to offer them help when they need it if they're afraid to come out and ask for it themselves for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's a great, great point because, you may not be out there posting, mm-hmm. you know, selfies like a
yeah. yeah, you don't have to post anything; just hurt what they're posting.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. You know, get it set up and you know, get in touch with people and use it for the connection tool that I think
exactly,
was
yeah.
originally intended for
yeah.
and not sharing like stupid cat photos and
yeah.
stuff like that, yeah. right? But yeah, use it for that purpose, and that way, you know, God forbid someone is reaching out for help. All their other friends, their feeds are filled with junk, like we were just
yeah.
talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They might just miss it because
yep.
it didn't pop up in their feed. But if it pops up in yours, maybe you're something.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so yeah, be there for them. You know, if you're in a leadership position, I would suggest that you make sure that your subordinates know that they can reach out to you if they
yeah.
need that type of help, and that mm-hmm. it's not going to be like a, you know, now your career's in jeopardy because you
right,
decide
yeah.
to get help. You know, like don't be that guy. You
know? Don't be that guy. Definitely.
Well, man, this has been a great conversation. I didn't want to get too in the weeds on your book because mm-hmm. I do want people to go out and get a copy of the book and actually read the book instead of, you know, having it all dictated to them
right
now.
Yeah, yeah.
But this has been, to me, it's been an enlightening conversation. And I think based on some of the talked about with your book, mm-hmm. the book is going to be very enlightening as well for mm-hmm. a lot of listeners who pick up a copy. Or will people be able to go and get a copy after they hear this interview?
Yeah, so it's, you're May 27th. So, yeah, they can get it through Casemate Books. They can just Google Born Fact of Conflict. But they can also, it's also available at Barnes & Noble, you know, Amazon. Probably the easiest way is just to go to my website, and that's just Pat Naughton. So P-A-T, you know, N as in number, AUGHTON.com. And then from there, you know, it'll link you to go where you can go purchase the book. But, you know, with the book, I really try to appeal to a broader audience. So for anybody who's, you know, listening to this, you know, it's not just another war book. It's mm-hmm. it has everything you can think of. If you're looking for that academic piece of the argument between both conflicts, it's there. If you want that human story, the human interest story of generational impact of conflict on society, it's there. If you want some war stories, it's there. Like, it's all there in that book, you know. And so I'm trying to, right now there's a real gap between those who serve and then the rest of society.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to try to create a book that would help with that understanding, trying to close that gap a little bit. And so I hope that's what I achieved with the book. And yeah, again, patnaughton.com. That's probably the best place to go if you're interested in purchasing a copy.
Excellent. Well, I'll have links to all of that in the show notes for mm-hmm. the listeners, and I'll make sure that they get access to all of that. But really, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Highlights and some of the stories that kind of came from your research and what went into this book. I think the book's going to be a great Looking forward to hearing more about it, you know, down the line.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on the show, conversation that you're doing for Vetrel.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.